I work for Ohio's public radio and television stations. We have several of them in all the major markets, and we have statewide reach, and we're lucky in Ohio to have a network of stations, radio and television, that do some really great work. So I'm very glad to be here. I'm glad to be out of the State House for a little while. It's been an interesting place. And like in other state houses around the country, we've had some issues of sexual harassment claims, and of course election this week. So it's been a good place to get away from for a little while. So, but I'm very glad to be here with David and Seth and Julia. And so right now I'd like to turn it over and have each one of them talk a little bit about how they got here and what they'd like to share with us today. So I'll start with you, Julia.
Okay, great. Thank you, everyone, for coming, and thank you, conference organizers, and Dave, for putting this together. This is great. What I tell people is I started blogging in 2014 because I live in Wisconsin, and the polar vortex made it too cold to run outside, so I was very squirrely, and I ended up spending a lot of time sitting indoors and kind of writing short pieces. My book was in the process of coming out, and at that time, the Obama presidency was kind of winding down, and I had a lot, it turns out, to say about that. And I kind of liked writing in these short posts. So that's how I got started doing this. And part of that was also at the behest of my editor at Cornell Press, as my book was coming out, was to tweet and engage. And I found I actually enjoyed engaging with journalists on Twitter. I hadn't really known a lot of journalists or spent a lot of time in that world up to that point, but actually found there was a lot of curiosity across those professional boundaries about what political scientists knew and what we had to say about elections in particular and presidential rhetoric, which is my other main area of study. And so I kind of got going on Twitter. I remember I picked up a lot of Twitter followers having a big back and forth with Sean Trendy of Real Clear Politics about the role of political scientists in the broader discussion. So it was a little bit idiosyncratic, a little bit accidental, but that was how I got started. And then at that point, Seth and some of the other founding members of Mistress of Faction invited me to blog regularly, and so I just started doing that. That's pretty much the story.
Hi. I don't have a really great origin story here, but I started my own blog, an independent blog called Enoch Rising, back in 2007. And my main motivation for doing it was just I felt like I have a piece to speak, And I had some knowledge based on political science. There were events going on. There was an upcoming election. And I just thought, well, it'd be nice to be able to weigh in on things occasionally and answer some questions and not have to wait 2 or 3 years to get rejected by a journal. just have some of the immediacy that I felt was lacking from the overall discipline. There was part of a discussion going on at the time about how there were other disciplines where there was more of a link between the academic research and news that you could use, basically. There were like medical reporters who were good at translating, here's the latest medical study on this, this will tell you coffee does cause cancer, doesn't cause cancer, or whatever. And there wasn't so much of that in the world of politics and political science. And I thought that, well, we could use more people like that, so why don't I just volunteer? And I kept working on that blog and eventually kind of defined more of a political role for it. And eventually in 2012, I got started with Greg Koger and Hans Knoll and Jen Victor to start Mistress of Faction. We eventually added our awesome expansion team, including Julia. And I also got invited somewhere within those years to start blogging with Pacific Standard. And I do a weekly column with them, and I occasionally do work with 538. But now I'm all over the place. I can't. It's kind of out of control. Yeah.
Yeah, out of control.
Yeah. So I arrived at the University of Akron in 2000, and just a traditional political science professor role. And then in 2005, I was named a fellow at the Bliss Institute. And the thing that I realized very quickly is when you're at the Bliss Institute, every media person, political media person in Ohio, calls the Bliss Institute wanting comments on just about everything. I realized that that was a role that I could assume. Dr. Green was very helpful in mentoring, and there's only one John Green, and he's only got so much time. And so he was kind enough to start giving me some media opportunities, which I ran with. And also the fact is Ohio is a battleground state. And every 4 years, the national media, not just local media, the national media descends on Ohio. Mike Ensley can attest to this, being from Kent State. It's really an amazing phenomenon. And so by being in the position I was at the Bliss Institute, I started to develop relationships not only with local media but also national media. And we at the Bliss Institute we're constantly being asked questions to comment on the current events of the day. And then in 2011, I made a mistake and I signed up for Twitter. Unbeknownst to me, I didn't realize what a time suck it would become. When I wake up in the morning, that's the first thing I do is check Twitter or get the notification to see what President Trump has said that morning. If he's overseas, you'll have a dozen or so tweets to look at and then to comment on inevitably. So it's kind of a balancing act because, all of us are traditional professors that are in the classroom, but we're all expected to have a bigger profile, not, be it social media or be it helping the media and give them our perspective.
And David's not kidding. Literally, outside, when I walked in, one of the first things I said to him was, my colleague Joe Ingles wants to talk to you about something. So he was literally calling her on the phone as we were getting ready to come up here. So he's not joking about the media and people like me calling him all the time. Which brings me to my first question here to the panel. The relationship that we have with you folks as pundits, do you feel that we rely on you too much? Do we not rely on you enough? Do we hold you to any sort of accountability and standard for being right that we might hold someone else to?
Well, I feel like we...
You're going to have to share that. Okay.
I do love a good microphone. So, yeah, I feel like the idea that we might be right about things is pretty much, we've gotten rid of that expectation, so I feel like the pressure has been lifted. Here's what I find the most awkward, and I don't think there's anyone here from Wisconsin public media, but you can feel free to share. Actually, it's usually commercial media, and they really want me to weigh in on kind of on the normative side of a question, right? They want me to weigh in on, like, is this good or will this plan work? And I am not a policy person, and, like, my guess is as good as anybody's about whether a healthcare proposal plan is going to work. But it's no better than anyone else's. And that I find really quite challenging is to be asked to weigh in on kind of to enter that political debate. It's fine to call and ask me, how do incumbents normally do or what, something along those lines. But that's the challenge I find is that people want us to be, they want us to be MSNBC commentators or something like that, and I don't want to do that.
I do kind of struggle with that because there's, different reporters will have different approaches. Some of them just want, here's what we're planning to say. We just want to attach a PhD to the quote.
Right.
And I'm a little uncomfortable with that. But also, if they're not going to let me just go off for 20 minutes because it'll be boring and they'll use none of it. So I'm sort of trying to find that balance all the time. But related to this, on the presumption of being right, I want to just bring up this one story of I got interviewed by a newspaper reporter from Toronto. I don't recall the newspaper, but in the summer of 2015, and he was just saying, what's the deal with this Donald Trump guy? We're having some concerns up here in Canada. We want to, tell us, is this how serious is this? And I'm like, don't worry. There is no way he's getting nominated by the Republican Party. And even if he did, there's no way he wins a general election. And the guy was like, you really seem very definitive about this. Are you concerned at all about your academic reputation if you're wrong? And I said, if I'm wrong about this, my academic reputation is the least of our concerns. So I think that was probably the most accurate thing I said in 2015. So.
Can I add something else to this? Sorry, Dave. I'm going to talk over you.
Thank you.
So I think one of the things when we're talking to media or when we're doing blog posts and public scholarship, one of the things that academics can be most useful for is kind of correctly conceptualizing something. So if you ask me a question of kind of what, you know, this guy is going to challenge Paul Ryan, what kind of thing is this? I can tell you, you know, this is a party outsider, or this is a, what we would call a quality candidate. We're pretty good at, I think, on the fly conceptualizing things, but this is also, I believe, at the root of the problem with Trump, is that political scientists misconceptualized what kind of candidate he was, and he was representative of a faction within the party, not some random celebrity outsider, even though he has some of those core characteristics. But it was a journalist who first got me to realize that I was wrong in listening to Seth about the nomination. I mean, didn't you co-write The Party Decides?
I'm an unindicted co-conspirator.
So I had, you know, I'm sort of agnostic on The Party Decides question, actually, but I had thought, you know, there's no way this Trump thing is going anywhere. And in September of 2015, I was on the phone with Perry Bacon, who was at NBC, I think, at the time, and now he's my colleague at 538, and he said, okay, why exactly do you believe this so strongly? What do you think is going to happen? And I kind of went, oh. But I didn't... I don't think Alan Abramowitz is here anymore. I didn't publicly say that I thought that it was likely that Trump might end up being the nominee until Alan had already done so in print. So that's my wrong punditry story. But I do think as a word of kind of advice for people who want to be public scholars and also for media people is that that's a real value added that scholars can have, is to sort of think broadly about types of phenomena in politics.
Yeah, I was going to say, I did the exact same thing that Seth and Julia did. I would get asked by the media, and I would say, Trump, are you kidding me? Doesn't have a shot. And even if he got the nomination, there's no way he's going to win the general election. And it was a very valuable lesson that I was taught that, you know, even though political scientists think that we can predict the future with great accuracy, and we were pretty good at it until 2016 in terms of the presidential elections. 2016 really showed that we should stay out of the prediction business as much as possible. And it was interesting because, just like Julia said, a reporter taught me that maybe I should rethink this. And I recall very clearly it was March of 2016 when NPR reporter Don Gagne was in town. And he had just visited a couple of labor union halls and talked with people. Talked with people in Lorain, I think it was, or Elyria. Talked with people in Canton. And he was in the area, and so you know, we got together for coffee. And he's like, I got to tell you, this Trump thing may actually happen. Those labor union folks that are traditionally Democrat, he goes, every single one of them that I talked to is supporting Trump. And here's why. And at that point, I started thinking, this might be an historic election. We may be in for something, you know, really, really different. And it was a very valuable lesson to show how, you know, from our political science perspective, we have history and we have our models and we have our theories. But sometimes it's the reporters that are actually on the ground talking to people that can inform us just as much as we inform journalism.
I'm glad to hear my colleagues in journalism are doing good work here, especially my colleagues at NPR. This is great to hear. But I think a lot of us turn to you folks to get a better picture on, we see polling results. What do they mean? We don't want to report this as just horse race. How do we have a better relationship so we don't put you in that position to predict, but we want to understand what's going on? Well, it's a tough position, though. I mean, you folks, what you're coming up with is more than just opinion, because anybody can have an opinion. We're turning to you because you've got data. You've got perspective that maybe we can't analyze.
Absolutely. You know, we're drawing on our political science theory. We're drawing on all the good research that is done in this field, and it is our job to try and take that and take the conclusions from that and to put it into a language that lay people and others that are not political scientists or that are not social scientists can understand. And that can be a big challenge sometimes because that, you know, you're speaking two different languages there. And so I think it's a bit of an art form to try and collapse all that research into something that is a lesson that people will understand.
Well, I think an example of that comes every election night when, you know, they'll call a particular race 5 minutes after the polls close. And I always get people asking me, well, how can they do that? That race is not over. Not all the votes are counted. And I think we turn to you folks because you can explain to people why, just looking at this map and looking at the numbers that have come in, that this is going to be the likely result.
Yeah, so that's interesting. I mean, one of the things that brings up is these inferences that we can make, right? And so the whole idea of making inferences is how to draw conclusions about something you can't observe based on what you can observe. And that's, you know, one area where that generally works pretty well is when the networks call. I still remember 2000.
There was that.
So there was that. But where that's, you know, where we have some reliable methods of doing that kind of inference, where I think one of the areas that's kind of challenging with engaging with members of the traditional media is the areas in which it's broadly assumed that something has a causal effect and it actually doesn't, right? And I think that's where a lot of us started blogging, was kind of correcting that. So often, you see this in campaigns a lot, right? A candidate makes a gaffe, it's a totally embarrassing gaffe, and you can't imagine that this person is going to be able to win based on that. And so political scientists, I think, are pretty skeptical of how much campaign events matter, and became more and more skeptical of this over the course of 2016.
Yeah.
or the range of behaviors that are fine. But in general, we find like the reasons people vote are a lot more structural. And so a lot of it is like being this naysayer with members of the media. Like, isn't this going to matter? No. Like,
we love it when we get that answer, too. That's the best. Yeah.
No, nothing matters. How's the economy?
Right.
I think, well, some journalists and definitely members of the public don't have a sense of how much in politics is actually very predictable and is very regularized. So, for example, Julie and I were doing live blogging for Tuesday night's election results, and I threw up a little chart. It was just a scatter plot it was the county level Virginia, I think it was the 2012 presidential election in each county and city, and then compared with the 2013 governor vote. And, you know, it's like nearly a straight line. It's like, you know, it's like an R squared of like 0.96 or something like that. And
I'm a journalist. I have no idea what you just said.
All it really means is that you can explain almost everything that happened in one year with what happened the other year. And I just threw that up there, and I got some comment on Twitter from, I think it was a physicist, who just said, I would immediately reject any relationship that strong if I got that in a journal. That just never happens in science. And he was just, is this unusual? I'm like, no, this is actually very regular. If you look within one state, or if you compare like the whole country by state, this is actually very typical. And in fact, if you didn't see these things, that's when you'd know that something really weird is happening. So, you know, when you get like, yeah, we can call a state based on like, you know, 2% of the votes coming in, that's because we actually know what's going to happen in every one of these counties just based on this very small sample of them. And those are actually, yeah, then it's worth explaining. Those are things I draw some solace from, knowing that there are still regularities in politics.
It's political science. Yes. There's a science here.
Yeah. People behave very, very predictably, even though everyone wants to think they're a special snowflake. I want to go back to the Trump. I mean, I often find that, right, when you talk to normal people, they're like, what? You can predict people? You do experiments on people?
Yes,
we do. But I want to go back to the Trump thing, because I think that was a case where it's not an issue that our predictive powers were wrong. It's an issue that we incorrectly conceptualized.
Well, the polls were right. I mean,
the polls were right.
Yeah. The individual state polls might have been off, but nationally the polls were right.
And the polls were wrong in a way that was actually somewhat predictable on the state level. It wasn't rocket science. But it was people's assumptions that a candidate like Trump couldn't be elected, and I think that was because, I mean, I'll just say it, right? That's because I think not a lot of academics, I think most of us have spoken to Trump voters. Someone was quoted in the press at APSA saying that most academics have never spoken to a Trump voter. That's definitely wrong. But most of us aren't friends with that many Trump voters. It's like, oh, that's my crazy uncle or my, like, rabid right-wing student, and not our sense of kind of what the normal population would do. And clearly that was wrong. Partisanship kicked in, and we knew that, right? Partisanship was not a new concept in 2016. We knew that one.
And that's actually, there have been some pieces that have come out from national media saying, we were wrong. We have now gone out and talked to more Trump voters and realized how we were wrong, how we missed this, and that we've been mischaracterizing some of these people all along. And so I'm just wondering how we break out of that, because it's very easy to call up the same people over and over and find out that you've gotten yourself into kind of this bubble, so to speak.
Well, I think people need to stop apologizing for 2016, first of all, because you're right. I mean, we mainly got it right. If not for the quirks of this crazy electoral college system that we have, and 80,000 voters in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan, candidates like Jill Stein, Russia's favorite on the ballot, this doesn't happen. And we're talking about a Hillary Clinton presidency, who, by the way, did win by almost 3 million votes in the polls. As you point out, we're right. So I think we need to get over the apologizing because we really weren't that wrong.
But there's a perception out there among some people, among some voters, that we were all wrong. That you folks were wrong, and I was wrong, and our whole industry was wrong.
Well, it was one thing to be wrong, as I very much was on the nomination side of things. I mean, there are a number of theories that explain, and there was a good deal of history to give you a good reason why Donald Trump would never be nominated, but then he did anyway. That's fine. But for the general election, the reason so many of us thought Hillary Clinton was going to win is because pollsters went out and asked people how they were going to vote, and that's what they said. And you didn't need to be an academic to see that. And that was it was just very basic. How are you going to vote? Okay, it turns out some people were not giving you the whole story about how they were going to vote. And fine, okay, that's you can have errors, and you can have errors in some key states. But I don't think we were wrong to make that prediction. All the best evidence that we had available at that time was leaning that way. And, only through hindsight would we know that, oh, of course, Upper Midwest, they were shy Trump voters. We could not know that in advance.
I don't think the shy Trump voter theory has been proven. There's an alternative theory that rural voters were under-polled. Either they were under-sampled or they weren't answering the phone. And I think there's just as much evidence for either of these theories, and maybe there's a little bit of both. But the fact that we have theories that explain systematically why we would undercount certain voters suggests that there's still something to be said. So, yeah, I'm done apologizing for 2016.
I'm still getting, well, not as much. I'm fortunately working for public radio. I don't get too many calls asking me to apologize for what I said in 2016. But, moving on from that, I know the data is just coming in from Tuesday. And yet everybody is still rushing to say what Tuesday means compared to 2016 and what Tuesday will mean compared to 2018, here in Ohio we've got 5 executive offices on the ballot, including governor, what it's going to mean for the congressional races next year, what it's going to mean for 2020. It's way too early to do this, isn't it? But we're doing it anyway.
Without a doubt. I mean, I have no idea what Tuesday means because... tomorrow is another day, and maybe an indictment comes down, which changes everything. You see
it
somebody.
Used to be far-fetched.
I know. You see somebody from the White House getting hauled out in handcuffs. You know, it changes things. Or we get into we have another national natural disaster that's a catastrophe, or a war. You can't really predict. But what political scientists can say, based on patterns, based on history, based on theories, is, all else being equal, 2018 should be a pretty good year for Democrats. And why do we know this? We know this based on our theories. We know this based on a low presidential approval, plus the economy. Now, the economy is doing pretty well. Who knows what it's going to be doing in a year? But we've never seen presidential approval this low at this point in a presidency. That's a good thing for Democrats. Now, it's also possible the Democratic Party can completely screw it up, and I wouldn't be surprised if that happens. But I think overall, it should be, it has the potential to be a wave election year, just like 2010 was, just like 2006 was.
So, can I jump in here? Yeah, so I'm going to slightly disagree with you, Dave.
No.
We don't know what... our 2018 predictions aren't based on theories. Right. I think we actually don't have... one accepted theory as to why the president's party tends to lose in midterms, but it's based on an empirical regularity. that tends to happen. And it's happened in more dramatic fashion more recently, right? Where midterm elections have been, the last three have had some wave characteristics. I would like to take this opportunity to promote the blog post that I put up yesterday.
Shameless plug.
Completely shameless plug. But it was on this question of how to interpret Tuesday's election in light of what happened in 2016 and how to think about factors that drive elections that are structural and then how to think about the more immediate factors that are often more idiosyncratic and where Tuesday fits in with that, and then also thinking about the concrete implications of an election, like the people who got elected. And that I think is the biggest implication is that the Democratic Party has built up a farm team of office holders and some interesting people that seem to have a lot of political talent. And so when we look at what an election means, we don't want to just look at like the big picture narrative. We want to actually look at what is going to happen afterward and what that says about our political system.
Yeah, just related to this, and this is poaching a little bit on Julie's research, one of the things after the people involved in politics finish with the election, the very first thing they do next is try to interpret the election. And that's important for various sides. It's immediately some people were saying, well, this proves that you need to have a racially diverse group of candidates going up and that those people will win. Some people are saying, well, this proves that moderates will win because you need to put more of those people. And, you know, everyone sees the election in terms favorable to them and their teams. And honestly, you don't really need a whole lot to explain what happened. I mean, we know in a non-presidential year, the president's party will tend not to do well. That party will do even worse if the president's unpopular. That kind of explains pretty much everything that happened. But it's interesting to see the competition over defining it unfold. And I kind of like watching that.
Well, you say everyone sees. Actually, on election night, not everyone saw what was going on. I was amazed watching returns at the State House. We had two statewide issues, so both of our reporters were out covering those, and I was kind of holding down the fort. And I was changing back and forth between the channels, and CNN was doing its usual, you know, magic wall and the crawl in the lower thirds and the panel, the cast of thousands all there talking about what was going on. And Fox News was acting like it was a totally regular day. There was no reference to the election at all. I even tweeted out a picture of both of the networks almost simultaneously, and it was like there was no election going on. It was astounding to me. Now, I understand that they were doing stuff on their website and on social media, but to actually watch television, there was no reference to an election happening at all. It was amazing. But that brings up the whole idea of social media. We have, you know, years and years of data where you can predict these things that have happened. But has social media really just thrown it all off and made it even harder to look at trends? I mean, you've got the formula that you just said that I still don't understand what you meant. But does social media affect that? Does talking about 2016 affect how the voters did in 2017? Will it affect how they do in 2018, what they do?
We know yet. I don't think social media has been around long enough to generate really useful data about that. I think that there's, and the research that is there, which I don't have immediately off the top of my head, but I think it's kind of ambivalent, the results of studies of social media about how it affects voters' viewpoints and things like that, right? There's some evidence that people are living in social media bubbles and this is contributing to polarization. There's also evidence that the people that are the most polarized are people who are least likely to be on social media. I think there were some pieces in the Washington Post about that. But I think it does, it increases the hunger for an election narrative, right? It makes elections, I think, kind of 19th century style, kind of a circus, right? Thinking back to like politics used to be fun, and yet it was dirty and messy and terrible and name-calling, but
was.
It was fun.
Was.
And now
was.
It is again. If you think back to the 90s, voter turnout was lower and everything was boring, right? So there's trade-offs there, and that's my read on social media, on the role of social media. It makes politics funny.
I was going to say it certainly impacts how I do my job because there's such a time commitment in trying to keep up with what seemingly is breaking news every hour. I don't even remember what the Obama years were like at this point. You know, it seems like it was 20 years ago, and it was a fairly boring time compared to right now. And just the amount of information coming in, and it's amplified by social media. You know, it's not like we have to wait until the evening news to get our news, or wait till we get the New York Times or Washington Post in the morning. It is changing literally by the hour, now by the minute. And really the only way to keep up with that is through social media. And it's amplified on that. It's definitely changed how I prepare, not only to talk with you folks, but also even to, you know, get in the classroom, because inevitably my students will ask me questions about things that news that broke 5 minutes before I stepped foot in the classroom. And half the time we'll be like, what are you talking about? I was just walking down here. I just, you know, I was walking down the stairs. How could it have changed so fast? Yes.
There's been one thing, and this is a little aside from your question, but one thing I have liked about social media, particularly Twitter, is that I honestly get a lot of my news from Twitter. But I will see news coverage of a topic, and I'll catch something that I think is incorrect, or I think that they missed some important aspect of it, or they're interpreting a statistic wrong, or something like that. And I can write directly to the reporter and just say, actually, here's this, and I could link something else. And I've gotten occasionally, oh, thanks, we didn't know that. Here, now we know this. And they've corrected me on things that I've written, and there's actually a little bit of a dialogue. I mean, that is social media at its absolute best. It doesn't always happen that way, definitely. but it's nice. It's much more, it's more of an interactive media environment than it used to be.
And that's great. When we are able to connect with people, I mean, I really like the opportunity to engage on social media with people, because there's things I don't know, and I'm the first person to admit that. But, you know, I'm wondering, as political scientists, you think about things that affect voters, the weather, and, you know, a perception that their candidate is up by a certain point or whatever. I mean, social media has to be coming into play here. And when you see pieces just this last week about this is the anniversary of Trump's election, do you think, I mean, I know you don't want to predict, but do you think that that played a role? I mean, to talk about what things were like a year ago, did that make a difference, say, in Virginia and in New Jersey? I know Democrats were polled, the poll showed they were going to win, but could that have made a difference?
I don't know if it was social media, but it was certainly Donald Trump's unpopularity, I think, had an impact. We've never had a president come into office and you know, within a year. Well, first of all, I don't believe it was ever over 50%. But he is regularly now in the mid to low 30s. I mean, this is insanity. We've never had this since polling was invented. That's how unpopular he is. And so I think without a doubt that had an impact. You know, but social media clearly has an impact. You know, if you have a video that goes viral, you know, for instance, of a congressman threatening to throw a reporter off a balcony, Michael Grimm in New York, I mean, that's going to have an impact.
Well, and especially when it makes then the mainstream broadcast news.
Absolutely.
For people who are not on social media.
Without a doubt. So the question is, you know, how do you measure that? And Julia's right. I mean, social media, it seems like it's been around forever. It's only really been a few years. We don't have a whole lot of time to be able to compare.
I want to include the audience here in questions here in a couple of minutes, so please think of something that you might want to ask, because I'd love to hear what your ideas are. But I want to ask you folks here on the idea of social media. You know, we're now just finding out some of the details about Facebook and Twitter and the fake ads, and I mean there was the fake news that was being put out there, and how do you? It's still just kind of hard to wrap your brain around how that might have affected. If you have 126 million people or whatever, 36 million, whatever it was, who saw this, how did that affect what happened? And some of these people were just firmly convinced this was real. And how do you look at that?
I think it's a serious problem. And I think there are people who legitimately cannot tell the difference between a well-sourced newspaper story and one that's completely fabricated. I do think I did a post on this earlier this year about looking at newspaper coverage of Richard Nixon right before his resignation, And, you know, in particular, there were a number of journalists who were traveling around the rural Midwest and trying to talk to his conservative white supporters. And they were saying, oh, you know, well, we just think this stuff is all made up. And it's just it's the elite liberal media who have it in for the president. And, you know, look, you know, why don't people pay attention to the real scandals like the crimes going on in Chicago? I mean, it's the same exact narratives that have been going on for 40 plus years. So in some sense, this isn't a whole lot new. I don't know if it's more toxic, if it's more viral than it used to be. But people have a very long-standing ability to believe whatever they want to believe.
But and it's comforting to know that this is not the first time, because, you know, there are those of us in the media who are a little bit scared by, especially when you hear from the president, the White House, that we are not to be trusted. And that's very, very concerning. And so if people don't trust us, then by extension they might not trust you anymore. And then what happens?
I think that ship sailed long ago.
Yeah, they don't.
I'm trying to be optimistic here, you know?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, I tend to be on the team of many of the elements of Trump that people find bothersome are remixes of old things that have already happened. But I do think there's a strain of anti-democratic rhetoric that's being pretty widely disseminated that's concerning. I think it's important to kind of keep our eye on that prize. The fake news stuff is obvious. I don't think it's good. I don't think it helps democracy, but I think it mostly activated people's partisanship. And that you could understand most of how people voted in 2016 by looking at their party identification. So it's not like it took people who are hardcore, lifelong Democrats and millions of them all switched over to become Trump supporters. Everyone can find an example of that, but mostly that's moderate or conservative Democrats that had been slow to change their partisanship. But I think it's exactly as you said, it's the attacks on the enterprise of the news media and the sort of whipping not just the electorate, but the conservative base in particular, into this frenzy around populist attacks on the media that is concerning. And it is not totally new, but it is not something that is a normal occurrence in American politics.
And I think it's been taken to a new level. This is the first time in American history we've had a president really go after the media like Donald Trump has. No president has ever said that the media is the enemy of the people.
But they have censored the media during wartime and things
sure.
like that.
I mean, without a doubt, but you've never had a president literally come out and say the media is the enemy. Trump is trying to delegitimize the media. And I think there's nothing more important for a democracy than a very vibrant, healthy, and robust media. And to me, I think it's extremely dangerous, it's very anti-democratic, and I think it's a real threat to our political system.
How can we, I'm wondering, we haven't helped either in the media. I mean, I'll take some of my public broadcasting colleagues out of this, but there's, you know, when there's a lot of back and forth on programs where there's shouting and there's talking heads and there's angry words and the whole panel is yelling at each other. That doesn't help either, because that doesn't exactly contribute to nuanced political discussion with a lot of thought behind it, right?
Well, it's true, but Sean Hannity's not a journalist. You know what I'm saying?
And that's another thing. There is a very, very bright line between personalities and journalists. And but once again, I don't think people necessarily know the difference. I think a lot of people think Sean Hannity's a journalist, Rush Limbaugh's a journalist. Right. There's a whole list of them.
Yeah, so I'm not sure if this is exactly addressing the kind of talking head cable news problem, but I think in general one of the issues with the role of the media is that it's kind of a victim of its own success. People take for granted that there's a news media that's going to be doing whatever it does and that we're going to have this robust and rich media environment. I think that that's something people don't really think about, the fact that that's not true everywhere, and think critically about that role. So one of the things I found most interesting this week that hasn't gotten a lot of attention in the post-election interpretation is Danica Rome, who won seat in Virginia, is, you know, people have talked a lot about her being one of the first transgender people to be elected, but she's also a journalist, and she's made a point of talking about the role of journalists. I saw one of the video clips where she was saying, I'm a journalist, and the role of journalists is to hold power accountable. And that's, like, I learned that taking Journalism 150 20 years ago in college, but people don't, like, we don't hear that a lot. I've been guilty of this, right? The media did this, the media did that. I wrote a piece of how the news media helped elect Donald Trump, and I stand by the inferences I made in that piece, but I think that some of it is like we take for granted what a news media can do for us. I'll give the microphone back to you now. Grudgingly, I hand it over.
One of the things I've actually found, like if there's a positive news story of 2017, has been honestly the role of investigative journalism. There have been a lot of very serious people. I can think of people at the Times, at the Washington Post, and a lot of other places, and including TV yes. and radio, who have actually done some serious investigative work and uncovered serious things. That's been great. And sometimes, and occasionally, when I'll watch CNN, I mean, there are actually serious people who are doing serious work. But then, once a revelation comes out, then they go to, you know, the four people or the Hollywood Squares version of pundits or whatever it is.
Jeffrey Lord.
Jeffrey Lord. Oh my God. And it's just, and I think we're sort of seeing kind of the limits of the for-profit media model there, where they realize that, well, of course, anger and arguments, people will tune in to watch that. And so
that's
we need
good
to have
TV,
some of that.
I'm
that's
told.
Great TV. And you can only look for a missing airliner for so long. But it gets old. And there's very little information actually transmitted there. So, yeah.
You know, I agree with Seth. I think this is kind of a renaissance, I think, for the media. I think there's so much good investigatory effort out there with this new administration and this crazy campaign and looking into both candidates and into their finances, some of the work, especially done at the Washington Post. I mean, it's just really incredible. And the media is too quick to again, apologize instead of saying, look at all the fantastic work we've been doing.
Yeah, well, we're not dead yet.
Right.
Does anyone have a question that you'd like to... Oh, I'll come over to you.
It's not exactly a question. It's a comment that I don't think I've heard anyone mention the Russians and their effect on social media on this election. Has anyone mentioned it?
How about that? I mean, obviously they were pushing... Yeah. All sorts of things, still doing it. I mean, what's that doing, not only just to people on social media, but the after effect to people that aren't even on?
I think it was implicit in the question about social media and the some of the fake stories on there. It's kind of implicit in that. And I think, you know, we've only scratched the surface to really see what the Russian influence was during the election, but also continues to be. I think finally Facebook and Twitter and other social media platforms are waking up to this and hopefully are putting safety measures in place to prevent that kind of influence. But I'm really not an expert in this kind of espionage and foul play.
One thing I always try and do is I try and interpret what we hear about that in light of what we know about campaign effects in American politics, which we know tend to be pretty meager. That, you know, no matter, you know, how many radio ads or TV ads you're showing, they usually don't change very many minds. It's actually hard to find much of an effect on election day. And then that, we're somehow trying to marry that with the idea that... you know, that a handful of Russians know how to hack our system. And it's just, there's a disconnect there. It's not necessarily wrong, and the fact that they're even attempting to on a large scale is something that's pretty shocking, and that the White House is not responding to it is also pretty shocking. I don't want to just, you know, come away with the impression that, you know, $1 billion worth of campaign fees here in the U.S. can't tip an election. But the Russians figured out how to.
Just in terms of what we know about how people vote. So if the results of the 2016 election had been wildly different from what political science models predicted they would do, then I would say we need to really think very seriously about that. But they're not. The results were very much what we would have predicted based on the economy and how long the president's party has held the White House, and again, partisanship predicted most of it. The other thing I think is important to remember about the impact, or I think very limited impact on the Trump vote from these ads, is that the Trump's demographic is an age demographic that is on social media much less than younger people. So that runs against the idea that social media is what tipped it over for Trump. Trump had, I mean, there are very strong age effects in the election outcomes, and there's very strong age effects in social media use. And finally, but I would say, like, I don't want to downplay the bigger Russia story. I think the potential collusion and the potential even just poor judgment coming out of the White House and failure to distance themselves from things that may have happened, that's a problem. And I think everyone should be concerned about that across the ideological spectrum. But I think the social media hacking is probably not what tipped the election.
Let me disagree just slightly. I just don't think we can say, really. And it's not that many votes that needed to be changed in Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin. Again, 80,000 votes. Sounds like a lot. It's actually a very tiny number. And those are the number of votes that tipped the election. And whether it was the Russians micro-targeting Trump voters to rally the base, or maybe suppressing potential Hillary voters that then stayed home in those states or ended up voting for Jill Stein or for Gary, what's his name?
Johnson.
Thank you, Gary Johnson, the Libertarian. And both those third-party candidates they got a lot of votes in those states. We don't really know, and I don't know if we'll ever know. But I think it's an extremely serious problem, and I hope that we won't be asking similar questions in 2020.
Anybody else have a question? Oh, my gosh. Well, I have to go to Dr. Beck. I took his class.
Thanks, Karen. One thing I wanted to ask you to comment on is that it strikes me that the role that we as political scientists play best is objective analysis, and objective analysis that really kind of reiterates what the fundamentals are about elections. Where we sometimes go astray is that we all live in our own bubbles, and that bubble, particularly in this election, was a bubble of people with college education, for those of us who teach, younger people, people who are probably mostly Democrats. And we have to really be aware and beware of that. And I often get commentary when I'm on Karen's show or somebody else, one of my colleagues will say, "You sounded like a Republican." And that is what I appreciate, because I want people on the other side to think, or people maybe on my side, to think, well, I'm bending over backwards to try to be objective. And that, I think, is our role. We do less well on the things that are, what, current affairs, mm-hmm. in a way, responding to that. We're just voters, essentially, and kind of giving our opinion on things. So comment on that.
I wholeheartedly agree, but I'll admit it's a struggle, right? Because we're also human. And especially when you're talking about an election like 2016, where there's so much passion on both sides, and you really feel that what you say is going to potentially make a difference, right? And it's hard to put on that professor hat all the time and be objective. I think it's something that we should always strive to do. But I think I know I've failed at that at times, and I'll probably continue to fail at that. But I'll always strive to be as objective as possible.
So Seth and I were actually talking about this over lunch, because we really tried to do that on Mistress of Faction, to be, academic on that blog. And it's been a real challenge. I think it was not so much of a challenge maybe even during the election or during Obama's presidency, but it's been a real challenge in the age of Trump because of the norm violations. And I think I have an easy time not blogging about policy issues because I don't know that much about them. But on a deeper level. But when it comes to the practice of the presidency, that's where my expertise lies, and it's hard for me not to be frustrated with the way that this administration has treated constitutional limits. But the other thing I would say in response to this excellent point is that it's true that many academics don't have a lot of people from some of these Trump demographics in our lives, but also that's not the only demographic that I don't really interact with. And I think about that a lot where I'm located, because I'm in the city of Milwaukee, which is a majority minority city. A lot of people in the middle of that city are not doing very well, are predominantly people of color, and I don't see very many of them on my campus either. And so I try to think about not just the perspectives I'm not getting from one side of the spectrum, but there's a broad range of perspectives, particularly marginalized ones, that are not part of my daily experience. And that's where I think we can learn a lot from reading work written by people in those groups, by people who have spent time trying to understand them, and just try to think more broadly in that regard.
So just to comment on this real quick, Paul. I was thinking as you were talking about this that how much I valued the statistics part of my graduate education and teaching me about, you know, understanding whether my sample is representative of the larger population. And then as I'm thinking about it, I realized, okay, I actually learned this as an undergrad as well. I was taking a statistics class there. This was at UC Berkeley. At the same time I was taking this class, this was when the Gulf War was breaking out. And there were all these protests all over campus against George Bush and the Gulf War, and I was very eagerly participating in all these things. We were marching up and down University Avenue. We actually sat in on 880 freeway, and cops came along and chanted with us. I mean, it was like, you know, what a great moment. And then the next day, like, a poll came out saying, like, 95% of the American people supported George H.W. Bush on the war. And I realized, I'm not in a representative group here. And that was a really important, it was depressing, but it was a very profound moment, and it's kind of stuck with me. And I really don't think I've ever written a blog post or an article or anything that starts off with, I was in the cab and the cab driver told me this. And I really don't want to go the Tom Friedman route on this thing. To understand that what I am experiencing is not necessarily representative of what most people are doing, and just always maintain that distance.
And let me just follow up and say, sometimes I think that somebody like myself is misperceived as being partisan or ideological. When simply I'm not at all. I'm actually looking at, for example, the occupant of the Oval Office and looking at it from the perspective of the institution, an institution that I've studied for, you know, 20, 25 years. You know, I will tell anybody. I've told numerous people publicly. I think that the current president is wholly unfit to hold the office by every measure. You know, from experience to temperament, to lacking a soul, and you know, there are some basic traits that you need as president, yes. But that is not,
he is less than 0.05,
right? Yeah, okay. But that's not a partisan statement, because I would say it if he was a Democrat, I would say it if he was a libertarian, and I would also tell anybody that asks, you know, if John Kasich were elected president, we wouldn't be having 95% of the conversations we're having on social media. We just wouldn't, because John Kasich as president would not be attacking the presidential institution and doing things that chip away at the actual regular functioning of our government. And you know, John Kasich's a Republican. Donald Trump's a Republican. It's not a partisan criticism. It's simply criticism of a political scientist that is viewing the occupant of this institution and seeing what he's doing to it. And I think sometimes that's misperceived, former students, other followers on social media, other people that may be listening to this on whatever format. And I think we sometimes get criticized for that.
You get criticized for people thinking you're partisan. Yes. I hear that.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Any other questions?
Yeah.
I'll come to you first.
This is something that you were just touching on a second ago. In taking on a more public role, do you encounter many haters? And if so, how do you deal with that?
Being a woman on social media is great. Smooth sailing. Sorry, Dave. You were.
No, I was just going to say I've had a few. I've had a few. I've had some people I've had to block on social media. I've had some anti-Semitic things thrown at me. And it's something I expected. And you grow a thick skin. I am particularly proud of the fact that Sebastian Gorka actually blocked me. So that's fine. I knew I made it into the club. So it's true.
Yeah. Haters, I've had a few. No, there's an unseemly side to all this, and it is it's bothersome. And it's, you know, in particular, if you are anything other than a straight white male between the ages of 25 and 45, you're going to get something, you know, not just a criticism of your work or what you're saying or anything like that, but something about who you are. And I hate seeing it. And in particular, I hate, you know, the fact that I like to, not only do I do this, but I encourage people to get involved in this work. And I have junior colleagues who I'm just saying, hey, this is a great way to get your work out there and to get people talking about it. But I have to temper that with the idea, oh, by the way, people are going to say these things about you. And I don't know if I'm being responsible at all in doing that. It's something I'm struggling with.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I don't know if I have any really, you know, well thought out solutions to this, but I will say that the peak of it for me was actually during the primaries, because I was live blogging regularly with 538, and they have a pretty big readership or followers on the internet, and the Bernie people really were legitimately nasty. I don't know, maybe they were all Russian bots. But my experience, yeah. I have since closed down all my Twitter notifications, so I can only interact with you if you follow me. Otherwise, I'm not interested in having those interactions. But my worst interactions were almost all from men, and they were not mostly conservative men. They were men on the left, mm-hmm. and they were pretty nasty and pretty threatening, and there were threats of violence. And someone emailed me after the election and made a remark about my cat, as I had tweeted a picture of my cat, and I was, you know, it was someone in town, so I got to explain to the campus police what MAGA meant. That was fun. That's probably the low point of it for me, but yeah, it's cross-partisan, and I don't know if I've really systematically compared with the men who also blog in American politics, but there aren't all that many women, especially not a lot of women of color, doing this sort of poli-sci American politics public scholarship, and I think that's not an accident. So thank you for asking.
I guess I was going to ask a similar kind of question. I try to do a little bit of what you're doing, but I find that having feelings gets in the way, right? It makes me sad when I write something and 5 minutes later everybody hates me because I'm like a college professor from Massachusetts. But there's a flip side to that too that I worry about, that if I write something and it gets recirculated, I'll be like, oh, I need to like do more of that, right? I need to come up with some snide, clever thing to say. And so at some point, I start questioning my objectivity. So I guess the question is, how do you make productive use of the feedback you get from people, or how do you train yourself to ignore it if you can't make productive use of it?
I couldn't do it if I didn't train myself to ignore it. So that's how I do it.
I mean, oof. I'm able to shut a lot of it out, honestly. And just say, well, there's idiots out there. And I'm honestly trying to find the balance. So I actually just did a post at Vox the other day that, you know, it got a little bit of attention late at night, and some people were saying, oh, did you do this? Did you do that? And some people were saying, I disagree with this. And fine, you know, have this argument. I don't need to be a part of this argument. But then one guy said, I think you coded this wrong. And I looked at it, and he was totally right. Which had me, you know, so I'm glad this person caught that. I'm glad I read that. And then I, you know, sent a note to my editor at Vox in the middle of the night saying, can you please change this, remove this graph, it's actually incorrect. Yeah. And they did that very quickly. And so, you know, and then I'm able to acknowledge I had to correct this, you know, this is solved. So in that case, it was actually very useful. And that improved the product. I think it's also fairly easy to tell the difference between that and someone who's like insulting me.
And also sometimes you don't know what is actually going to go viral and to kind of strike a nerve and not, you know, I in the last year I've written three pieces for CNN, their opinion pages, and I thought, wow, these are great. This, you know, it's going to go viral. It's going to be unbelievable. And you know, it's got like 12 retweets. You know, and then I'll just say something on Twitter in 140 characters, and all of a sudden it's you know, got thousands. So there really is no rhyme or reason.
Well, I think we have to wrap it up, but I want to give a shout-out real quick to Ted Celeste back there with the National Institute on Civil Discourse, because I think a lot of what we're talking about here really relates to what his group has been trying to do to try to just bring back a little bit of civility and rational conversation in amongst the haters and everything else. So, but thank you all very much. It was really entertaining for me as a journalist to hear, and I hope you folks enjoyed it. So thanks.
Thank you.
Nice job.
That was good.
Thanks
for
great job. Yeah, it was fun. Should I not have said that the president doesn't have a soul? Is that not?
Well, I just...
Oh, my gosh.
I just want to be able to prove that.
That's right. That is...
Yes, big fan.